Welcome, everybody, on this public holiday. Whether you've been coming to this church for many decades, and we've been here for 150 years, whether you're fairly new or have just dropped in, whether you've come from afar, or whether you're attending on webcam or listening back later on the website, you are most welcome. My name is Paul Murray. I'm a member of this congregation, and every now and again we take a turn at taking the service in the absence today of Bridget Spain, our minister. It's my turn today. Every Sunday in Unitarian churches throughout the world, a chalice is lit to symbolize the rights to religious freedom, inquiry free from religious dogma, and our communion with other liberal congregations. So we join churches from around the world in dedicating ourselves to freedom of religion. Our first hymn is number 77, Seek Not Afar for Beauty. This church is not, as the saying goes, a club for saints, but a hospital for people with human weaknesses and faults. It is where we should be free to face our failings, to acknowledge our many imperfections. It's a place where we come for a community of spirit, where we will not be judged, and hopefully a haven where tolerance remains supreme. But also, it's an arena where we have to be prepared to be discomforted when, as is encouraged, we encounter views that are not our own. We may not always like the service, the readings, the address, and the music, but we believe that this is sacred ground. And when we leave on Sundays, we feel we have done something which, in whatever small way, enhances us spiritually. If we could turn now to the back of the book and read our manifesto. Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest for truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge and freedom, to serve mankind in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow in harmony with the divine, this do we covenant with each other and with God. Our reader today is Frank.
Acardia, friends, my reading today is a poem by Seamus Healy called Beacons at Bealtaine, which was composed for an EU enlarging ceremony on the 1st of May 2004, when the EU, under the Irish presidency, welcomed 10 new nations into the European Union. The EU and Ireland are again welcoming new friends. This time, it is our Ukrainian brothers and sisters seeking refuge at a time of unnecessary horror. Heaney said of his poem that the early Irish legend denotes that Ireland's first magical inhabitants, the Tuatha Dé Danann, arrived on the shores of Ireland on the 1st of May, and that on that day the Druids drove cattle and sheep out to the pasture between two bonfires, hence the fire festival of Bealtaine. Heaney took his inspiration for the poem from the name of Phoenix Park, where all 25 heads of state gathered for a flag-raising ceremony. He said, "It is auspicious that we are celebrating in the Phoenix Park, named after the mythical bird that represents the possibility of ongoing renewal." But there are those who say the name Phoenix Park is derived from the Irish word Fionn Uisce, meaning clear water. And that coincidence of language gave him the idea for this poem. Beacons at Bealtaine by Seamus Heaney. Uisce, water, and Fionn, the water's clear. But dip and find this Gaelic water creek, a phoenix flames upon Fionn Uisce here. The Mayday hills were burning far and near, when our land's first footers beach boats in the creek. In Uisce, Fionn, strange words that soon grew clear. So on a day when newcomers appear, let it be a homecoming, and let us speak the unstrange word and give a welcome here. Like ancient beacons signaling peak to peak, from Middle Sea to North Sea shining clear, as Phoenix flames upon Fionn Uisce here.
Our next hymn is number 170. We are a gentle, angry people. For my own reading, I'm just going to read about an incident about 57 years ago. I shared a room in London's Camden Town, or indeed was it Cricklewood, I can't remember, with a man, let's say he was called Paddy. And we were both navvies, although he was a ganger earning far more than I was. And every day we toiled with many other Irishmen to construct roads and bridges. Every night, and I think I've mentioned this before in church, he, a gentle Kerry man, would kneel down by his bed to pray. He had imperfections, of course, although the only one I could identify was a certain bitterness. An understandable bitterness for the priest who told his wife she was not to limit her family, even by what we used to call in those days rhythm and blues. Bitterness because, as he said, they would prefer that he worked in London to support 12 children at home on a small farm, rather than stay in Kerry and be the father to 6 children. When he went home every year for holidays, no doubt to help conceive another child, the first thing he was asked was, "When are you going back?" And he'd say to me, "If I had an education, I'd write a letter to the Cork Examiner." I'll never forget Paddy. And this short poem is in his memory. And it's a memory of the many hundreds of thousands who had their hearts broken, their marriages and their relationships destroyed by callous religiosity. Austin Clark. "How many children have you?" asked the big redemptorist. "6, Father." "The last, when was it born?" 10 months ago." "I cannot absolve your mortal sin until you conceive again. Go home, obey your husband." She whimpered, "But the doctor warned me." Shutter became her coffin lid. She twisted her thin hands and left the box. Red-bearded saint had brought hell's flame to frighten women on retreat. Sent on his spiritual errand, it rolled along the village street until Rathfarnham was housing smoke. That suited the Jesuits in their castle. "No pregnancy, you'll die next time," the doctor had said. Her tiredness obeyed. That Saturday night, her husband's weight digging her grave. So, in 9 months, she sank in great agony on a Monday. Her children wept in the orphanage, huddled together in the annex, while proud of the black cross on his badge, the Liguorian at Adam and Eve's ascended the pulpit, sulfuring his sleeves and setting fire to the holy text. Austin Clark, the Redemptorist. Let us pray, let us reflect. And this brief period will be brought to a close by Josh with his music. On the times that we have failed our friends, let us reflect. On the times that we have been intolerant of others because of their views, let us reflect. And on the times that we've made unfair judgments about the behavior of others, let us reflect. Decades ago, David Lodge, a British writer, received some fame for his novel, How Far Can You Go? It begged the question, what were the limits to the sexual behavior of English Catholics in the 1950s and 1960s. And of course, it had a huge resonance over here, as the perennial query for teenagers, as some of us might remember, particularly Catholics, was often exactly as in the title, "How far can you go?" As you may remember, the RC and the Roman Catholic answer was basically that you couldn't go at all. And if you did, you were heading towards an occasion of sin, which itself was a sin before you could get down to do any decent sinning. It was all very fraught. But while we, perhaps mostly those of us who have a bus pass, may be amused now, the questions posed by Lodge did a number of things. It brought humour to one moral question which weighed down many generations. It highlighted that sexual activity is a core human preoccupation which, at some stage in our lives, affects all of us at some stage or another. And most important, it reiterated that, as most people believe, although not everyone, there are boundaries to how we behave. What these boundaries are has led to much dissension today and over the centuries. You will notice that we've been using the word sin, but some writers, including Richard Holloway, in his very interesting book, Godless Morality, Keeping Religion Out of Ethics, distinguishes between sin and immorality. Sin for him is essentially a religious idea, a disobeying of God, who is, in a sense, a father with a strict code for rearing children. Sin works on obedience rather than consent, expecting adherence to blindly follow what is commanded rather than cooperate with an end that is understood and voluntarily accepted. Indeed, he says, there are passages in the Bible where, in order to test compliance, God orders great wickedness to be done. However, even if we believe in the concept of sin, one that emanates from the religious area, it is not enough to say that this or that action is wrong, and it is wrong because God has said it. I'm told, just outside a town in the United States, there's a big sign on the entrance which says, "It's in the Bible, God said it, and we believe it." Even allowing for the view that the Bible is the Word of God, or is inspired by God, it is interesting that, as Leslie Weatherhead has pointed out in The Christian Agnostic, in the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus uses the word sin only 6 times and the verb 3 times. But then, of course, St. Paul made up for it. He uses the word sin 91 times. Thus, in Weatherhead's view, overburdening the Western world for centuries. It was missionaries, Irish missionaries, between 600 and 1200 AD, who exacerbated our sense of sin with penitential books spreading across the continent. A new dictionary of Christian theology outlines how interminable species of sin were described for which penances were parceled out. There were at least 20 forms of homicide, each deserving of a distinct penance. And indeed, we can reflect, up to recent times, children barely out of infancy were taught about mortal sin. For Catholics, part of being good meant having to go to confession, into the dark box, the title of John Cornwall's A Secret History of Confession, to be quizzed by a white-collared man in a black suit on our impure thoughts, by a man who had been trained to practice custody of the eyes, a man subject to being reported on by the ring of spies set up by Pius X. James Joyce, Edna O'Brien, Colm Tobin, Roddy Doyle, John McGaughan, and most famously, Frank O'Connor, have cast a cold eye on this sacrament, which perhaps has helped to reduce faithful penitence to a trickle. In the United States, it's estimated that only 2% of Catholics go to confession regularly. And I'm sure the percentage here has vastly reduced from the days when the real penance for sin was the long wait in the queue for confession rather than the 10 Hail Marys, the Hail Holy Queen. The background, of course, as we know, is that the Christian Church inherited its stances from the ancient Greeks. There's a good book, 50 Ideas You Really Need to Know About Religion, reminds us that Plato taught that the human body was evil because it distracted from the truth. Aristotle shared this view that women were inferior to men and were too ready to use sex to distract them from cerebral matters. You'll have seen that the Daily Mail in England has taken up this particular issue. Leading on to St. Thomas Aquinas, who believed that the state of marriage is preferable to that of even, sorry, that virginity is preferable to that of even continent marriage. So once you start digging, as Holloway says, the whole business of morality becomes more complex in its particularities. Frequently, he says, good moral systems compete and conflict. Ralph Helverson, who in his book Living in the Questions, very popular with Unitarians, says, we feel that our principles are unchanging, eternal, but others have principles that disagree with ours. He refers to people who seem to have no sense of the contraries of life, of the predicaments of human living, the contradictions and the evils that are all mixed up with what we call our good. There is a place in life, he says, where the spirit of man is hemmed in by narrow bounds that restrict his humanity. Montaigne, according to Sarah Bakewell, had a cheerful acceptance of whatever happened. This, she says, was at odds with Christianity, which insisted that people must constantly repent. Montaigne knew that some of the things he had done in the past made no sense to him, and just as he would not think of passing judgment on a room full of acquaintances, all of whom had their own views and reasons to explain what they had done, so he wouldn't think of judging previous versions of Montaigne. He said, we are all a patchwork, and so shapeless and diverse in composition that each bit, each moment, plays its own game. Henry David Thoreau, who you may remember Bill often quoted, made a related point. He said that if somebody advances to what he calls virtue, he had better look to his vices. Evil and good proceed apace in life, and as one develops, the other one comes alive. The man who assumes he is good, says Thoreau, is already on the way to inner rot. He has ceased to be sensitive to the corrosions and contradictions of life. Human beings, Julian Baggini writes, don't have to be perfect to be their wonderful best. Citing San Suu Kyi of Myanmar, Burma, and Mother Teresa, whose halos have been dented in recent times. There is so much good in the worst of us, and so much bad in the best of us, that it ill behoves any of us to talk about the rest of us, was a ditty from my childhood, which catches that we all have moral weaknesses bubbling along with our virtues. We have to remember, as Philip Zimbardo, the American psychologist, has said, any deed that any human being has ever committed, however horrible, is possible for any of us under the right or wrong situational circumstances. Susan Nyman, in Moral Clarity, outlines cases where the most abominable actions were accompanied with the insistence that they were honourable. She cites the courage of Voltaire, who spent his last years raging against about the case of Jean Calas, a Toulouse merchant whose son was found hanging in his father's shop. The family said it was murder. This was understandable, as people who committed suicide were not only deprived of a church burial, but were dragged naked through the streets. Voltaire said the father's stance was an act of paternal piety. The public disagreed, for the Calas family were Huguenots, and most French who were Catholic thought Huguenots were capable of anything. Jean Calas, they said, had murdered his son because he was about to convert to Catholicism. They celebrated the son as a martyr and his father. After a trial in which torture failed to produce even a hint of a confession or evidence, was broken on a wheel and burnt at the stake. And within the lifetime of some of us, a Wehrmacht soldier said he was proud that he only shot children. His comrade shot the mothers, and I shot the children. I saw the children couldn't survive without them, he said. A similar reason was given in more recent times by Hutu women who murdered the children of their Tutsi neighbors in Rwanda. The same country, by the way, where the United Kingdom wants to send asylum seekers. The nuclear bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were claimed to be necessary, says Nyman, to save American lives that would have been lost in an invasion of Japan. That, she claims, I don't know the truth of it, was false because the Japanese were willing to surrender. So, we churchgoers, recognizing that sometimes, even many times, we don't live up to ethical or moral standards, our own or ones imposed, or indeed avoid sin, have to ask ourselves, how are we supposed to live? We are frequently faced with moral, ethical difficulties. To be topical, what is stopping me hosting a Ukrainian refugee? Is it because the spare room is used for drying clothes and cultivating garden seeds? Or is it something more understandable? Was Kant right when he said, we are all inclined toward self-deception, endowing ourselves with better motives than the ones that really underlie our actions? Such possible self-deceptions often arise around sexual and reproductive issues. Adultery is and has generally been widely condemned, but is it always wrong? A man is in a vegetative state for 30 years. Is his wife sinning, being immoral, if she has a life-enhancing affair with his male nurse? Is this not a case of Christian love resting on a fundamental value judgment? Is a nurse in a nursing home immoral, although she does break a professional code, if she strikes up a mutually beneficial sexual relationship with a retired and dying professional man who had never had sexual experience. We will have heard, too, about the conundrums of direct and indirect effects that Catholic theology faces over ectopic pregnancies, well described in a book called The Puzzle of Ethics. And, perhaps, how do we feel about young people, old people, who have sex with each other whenever they like it, the way they might have a coffee or a hamburger on a good night out? Can we morally justify sex as an appetite to be satisfied, even if there is no necessary connection to any kind of relationship? Before we answer, we might reflect on the words of John Harris, quoted by Holloway, who says that for a moral judgment to hold weight, it must have something to say about why a supposed wrong action is wrongful. Do our moral codes allow for the fact that sexual orientation might change over a long life? So moral ethical choices are difficult whether our standards come from our religious or secular source. Indeed, Bernard Williams, the renowned UK philosopher, who died, I think, about 10 years ago, wrote that it was impossible to codify ethics into convenient moral theories. In terms of how people actually live, such a codification was not only unhelpful, but impractical. He said, according to Jeremy Harwood, in A Beginner's Guide to the Ideas of Great Thinkers, that philosophers have failed to engage with the real moral problems, stripping human life of everything that made it worthwhile through their failure to take account of the importance of individual integrity, the project central to a person's life, special obligations, and loyalty owed to family and friends. Perhaps this is unduly pessimistic. But through history, humans have wrestled impressively with how we should lead what may be described as the good life. And there are varying views and emphases. Some religions, for example, have laid great stress on individual ethics, while others emphasize social ethics. But the Dictionary of Beliefs and Religions says that all religions agree that ethics are necessary and they are relevant. Christians stress general principles of love and service. Jews and Muslims go into detail on the minutiae of ethics. Hindus stress social ethics of the caste system and non-violence, as do Buddhists. And at the other end of it, Jain monks wear masks and carry broom to avoid killing insects by swallowing or treading on them. The golden rule, never do to others what you would not want them to do to you, permeates many ethical teachings. Confucians speak of shu, or consideration for others. Buddhists say that a person who loves the self should never harm the self of others. Christians are enjoined to treat others as we would like them to treat us. And in Judaism, what is hateful to yourself, do not to your fellow man. Being Unitarians, we probably take our moral stances from many sources, perhaps with those of our parents dominant, however unconsciously. Here are some other suggested ethical moral insights around which we could build a coherent moral code. Or should I say, we could try to build a coherent moral code. We should challenge the extremes. Joe Humphreys, in his book, The Story of Virtue, writes about virtue ethics, which is a challenge to extremes, a mean that lies between two vices, as Aristotle said. Courage, for example, is a valley between cowardice and rashness, modesty between licentiousness and self-pity. By putting others first, we are in fact showing strength, not weakness. As Confucius says, what is ethically right is the opposite of self-interest. Moral judgments should depend on the situation confronted. We should try, this is a suggestion, to reject words like never, always, and absolute. Situation ethics asks, what is the best decision to help human beings? Unlike natural law theory, which looks to the law which humans are supposed to instinctively know. An action may be morally good because the intention is good, but not morally right. It might be a wrong action. And ritual and moral standards are different concepts. Too often, cultural religious obligations have been confused with moral standards, says Holloway. There are, of course, many standards we could emulate. The need for reverence, that we should seek the happiness of the greatest number of people. And moral codes from religious revelation, and no doubt there will be many disagreements of which are more appropriate. But to finish, I like the story of the United States theologian who got into a taxi with what turned out to be a rabid Republican driver. His father, the driver said, and his grandfather before him had voted Republican. "I take it," said the theologian, "that you will therefore be voting for a Republican president." "No," said the driver. "There are times that a man has to push his principles aside and do the right thing." Thank you very much. Our notices for the week, for next week. There's no offertory collection, but there is a donation box on the way out if you'd like to contribute. It is also possible to donate on the church website. There are copies of Paul Spain's Uskult magazine on the table, the May edition. Also copies of other magazines. Please take one. The lunchtime service by Pam is at 1:05 to 1:35 in the church and online on Wednesday. And next Sunday, there's a sale of plants after the service. All monies will be given to the Refugee Welcoming Committee. And Bridget has left me a list of a range of things we'll be able to get, from bedding plants to shrubs to all sorts of stuff. And the book club meets on the last Wednesday of the month via Zoom at 6:45 for a 7 o'clock start. And Bridget, by the way, is looking for, on the 22nd, she's looking for people to volunteer to read at a favourite readings service. Our last hymn, "When the Summer Sun is Shining," and that is number 66.